Let's get on now to what you guys have been working on. And one thing that stands out in my mind, of course, one thing I really wanted to talk about for sure was this archive.org and what goes on there. How did that get started, and what is it trying to do?
So I started collecting historical film in the early 80s, and we had a commercial business for a long time selling access to stock footage, and we did, you see our footage on all the major networks and in a lot of movies and so on. And we were trying to figure out ways to work with a lot more artists and independents. We never said no, but it was hard to get it out to, just as much effort and hard to get it out to people, and had to pay to duplicate material. It could be expensive. And when I moved to San Francisco about almost 6 years ago now, I came into contact with Brewster Kahle, and I was calling him about something else, and he said, "Oh, you have a film archive." We were sitting at dinner trying to figure out where we could get a film archive to put online for free. You want to put your archive online for free? And I was, I didn't know how to respond to that. I was pretty, pretty uptight about it. And then after a while working together, I realized that actually he was right. And so we started to put films from our archives up online for free. And this wasn't streaming media. This wasn't little thumbnails. This was like near DVD quality movies, and it was not restricted. You could go ahead and produce with the material. So suddenly there was this whole library of historical material up there that people could use in their own productions, and people started doing it on kind of a major level, including you guys. And
that's right.
There's been, a lot of really neat work has been made out of this material that just totally would not, people wouldn't go pay money to do it. They wouldn't have access to the material. And we've had like 2.5 million films downloaded, which is pretty amazing given that the films are totally obscure for the most part. And it's kind of changed our lives to get into the gift economy on that basis. I mean, we've met a lot of people, and we enter into kind of a semi-collaborative relationship with the world by offering this material to the world. And it also helps our sales. So the commercial people who are paying us, we're making more money. So
that's great. And it really is a great resource. I know for one, like myself and Angelo Sacerdoti, who made Fed Up about the genetically modified foods and all that. He was able to make use of a lot of that archival material. And speaking as somebody who, I had aspirations to be a filmmaker for a long time and just thought it's just too expensive. And then so eventually I got into video production for political and documentary reasons. What we had available to us before, there was an archive. I think Berkeley had some sort of government archive there. CBS, you could buy footage. I think CBS.org or something offers it for sale, but I could never even just view these materials, let alone pay for them and acquire them. And one thing that I will say made it possible for me to do with hardly any live footage that I had myself, because I didn't have a camera at the time. So I was able to download stuff about Pearl Harbor during the start of the Second World War. There was a big, campaign of hate mongering going on directed against Japanese people. And so I got to download some of that stuff and to use it in We Interrupt This Empire. And that was like really helpful. I never would have been able to do it without it. And that same goes for Boom, The Sound of Eviction. A lot of archival material in there about San Francisco. Never would have been able to do it. So it is truly an awesome resource. And I really want to let the other budding film video makers out there know about it. It's what's the website again?
It's archive.org/movies. And then you can click through, and there's a whole lot of things there. One of the things that's pretty interesting in the world right now is that, you know, one of the best ways to understand the present is to look at the past. We realize that a lot of issues are not new. They've come up in other forms before, or we have context to understand some of the issues that are burning now, or some of the conflicts and struggles that are going on. And there's wonderful things in archives all over the world. I mean, there's a potential. When you go to an archive and you look at the catalog or you look at the shelf, you just see hundreds of potential films or videos that you could make. You know, just it's buried still in the material, waiting to kind of break free. But there's so little archival access because of the difficulties and because of the expense and because of copyright, which maybe we can talk a little bit around down the road. And so, you know, we took, along with some other people, we took a step to try to make our material available and give people content to work with as a way of encouraging, you know, new production, new work, new creativity, and just kind of priming the pump. Brewster, you know, has done a lot of that. Brewster Kahle, who founded the Internet Archive, has been a real big supporter of that, and he's a major kind of, you know, direct and indirect supporter of independent media as well.
That's great. It's sort of a function of preserving history, you know, and making it available, because so much of history before, I don't know, President Eisenhower or something was more sort of a print-based culture, and a lot of knowledge, a lot of things were said, were kind of directed towards the print media because that was the media of our time, of that time. But we've since moved on into an electronic media-dominated era, for better or for worse, right? Marshall McLuhan and others maybe would say, you know, that's part of our problem. But nonetheless, these materials, these historic materials, it's funny. You know, I'm old enough. I'm like 40 years old. So I'm right at the generation where I'm not the 60s generation, but I'm not the X generation. You know, I'm kind of in the middle. And so I remember a lot of stuff from the 70s that was there, that was on network television. And it just so much of that, you know, eclectic content, different points of view being presented, historic references, all these kinds of things. So much of that stuff is gone now. And I don't know, when 9/11 happened, I don't know if you guys maybe had this similar kind of feeling of paranoia that, like, it's already happened, you know, they've already erased history. And then when they appointed, what was it, Poindexter to head up the Office of Total Information Awareness, which of course they realized that was a bad name and got rid of it. But they appointed this guy, Admiral Poindexter, who had been, you know, who had lied to Congress and was, you know, convicted for lying to Congress like 5 times during the whole Iran-Contra thing. And, you know, nobody where I worked at like an art academy, you know, potentially educated, cultured people. And I was walking, can you believe it? Poindexter is ahead of this. And people were like, who was he? You know, they'd already forgotten about him. And so I found this website at that time called, I think it's called memoryhole.org.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering if you guys had seen that. And if you had this similar feeling, this experience that, like, yeah, man, history is really...
But you know what's happening now that's kind of interesting with the internet is that individuals and groups are taking on the responsibility of making historical material accessible. So it's kind of a grassroots. I mean, there's this decentralized aspect. So, like, something gets censored off the networks. It's mirrored like a million places. Something goes on, you get what's his name from The Daily Show going on CNN and criticizing, you know, the major talk shows for being sensational and for, bringing American electoral politics through the mud, and like 300,000 people watch it on TV and 3 million people file share. So there's this intense grassroots thing going on, and it's sort of decentralization is kind of working.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm so glad you have a positive spin about that, you know, because it's so often easy to critique what the mainstream culture is doing. But, you know, the fact is these things are rippling through our culture. even though they may not have the big impact that we would like them to have right away, or they are kind of diluted. It is a media saturated environment, right? There's so much.
But there's so much like oppositional media going on now on like every level. I mean, on the level of indie media, but also on the level of, you know, straight and conventional media. There's so much of it. It's just, I mean, I'm older than you. I remember the Vietnam era, and it was so hard that any voice, you know, against the war and against the military machine at that period. There were three TV networks, you know, and like four radio networks, and that was like it. And now there's
well,
so much.
Well, put me straight on that. I always tend to glorify that era. One thing, I know it was problematic. It had some problems. But, you know, there was still, at least in the print arena, and you can go back and find evidence of this, say if you were a reporter at a news outlet in St. Louis, Missouri, or something like that. You were kind of an independent investigative journalist, and your paper had the chance to send you to Vietnam, and then you would file independent reports. So in some ways, you know, yes, broadcast journalism was, there's a lot of propaganda, a lot of censorship and control. But in some ways, for me, you know, I'm talking about 1970, really. I mean, the real protests of the Vietnam War for most Americans and what most Americans think of as the 60s didn't really happen till like 1970. And, you know, the four kids got shot in Ohio, and everybody knew this was bad. And it's sort of that's when it really hit. And that's when I started seeing long sideburns and afros around my neighborhood. It didn't happen until 1970. But at that time, and then you could turn on the TV at that time, and you would see stuff that was not so complimentary to what was going on in the Vietnam War, at least by then. I know there'd been years of propaganda before that, but by that time, there was a feeling that was at least acceptable to express, you know, on even in the broadcast media, and certainly with the slew of independent journalists. This was before the AP wire took over everything, and now it's just all the wire, or, you know, there's not a whole lot of investigative journalists out there anymore, and if they are, they're embedded, you know. So there was some advantages to that era, at least what I observed in 1970 compared to the sort of clear channel, you know, domination that we see, the total media market consolidation that's going on now. You know what I mean?
I mean, I think that's true, and I think the perception is, you know, totally accurate. But I also, the last couple years, there's so much oppositional culture going on right now. I think it's a pretty exciting time to be alive, even if it's a dystopian, screwed up time.
Well, what do you think about that, Megan? Do you think it's real? Like, one problem for this with me, with this this view, is that my mom never. When I talk to my mom, she's never looked at the Independent Media Center website. I mean, I've told her about it, but she's not a big internet person, you know. So it's still missing like a huge chunk of the country. It's great when I'm here in the Bay Area. I love it. Everybody connects to similar things that we know about and stuff. But once I leave that environment, I feel like I'm talking to people that all they've seen is Channel 7 and CNN. You know, I'm wondering.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't want to. I think a lot of people who were deeply affected by the political environment of the 60s and 70s kind of had their hearts beat out of them by the disappointments of the Reagan era, and are not, you know, a lot of them as. I don't want to foster any intergenerational criticism at all. But
it's okay. Speak freely here on Eclectique Politique. We're not afraid to even critique ourselves. We don't take anything serious here. No sacred cows.
But I find especially what you're saying to be true with people 55 and older, and I just would love to see more kind of cross-age participation in the oppositional culture. I think, you know, it's very vibrant and exciting, but you and I and are on the older end of a lot of it, and just would love for it to be broader. And I think that memory hole that we were talking about does apply to especially a lot of people who had you know, who became depoliticized over time. And some of the people that you're talking about, I know I've met them and traveled the country and talked to them. And, you know, that's like part of the complication of our era is while the oppositional culture is so alive, there's this simultaneous process of depoliticization that, you know, that's like a new challenge to people in our age groups and demographics who are doing new work to promote political literacy, is to figure out ways to make that political literacy kind of generative so that, you know, it has strength over time.
And you guys are right on the front lines of that battle and really doing it, I must say. The great thing about archival media in terms of displaying historical attitudes or anything like that is that it just speaks for itself. I didn't have to do anything to that Pearl Harbor stuff to show you, you know. Well, it's decontextualized over time, so the context of that era is now we can look back at it, and, you know, it looks so blatantly racist nowadays, you know, but when you put it right up against a reverend on TV talking on Fox News about why the Muslims hate us all over the world or something, it starts to recontextualize the modern era, you know, and the modern epic by putting it next to this old stuff. You know, it's really, I love to do that, and I love it that I don't have to provide any narration or commentary about it. It does itself. It sort of deconstructs the modern message by just putting it next to the old media, you know. But anyway, I wanted to get to a little bit more about archive.org just briefly, and that is, this is something that's not so culturally exciting maybe, but tell me, Rick, I've had trouble sometimes, and I'm not the best technically, but maybe if you can't do it quickly, that's okay. We'll talk about it another time or put it online. But what's it like? I had to download it, stuff as like MPEG 2s, I think, or 4s. MPEG 2s are the ones you try to download. They're more edit friendly format,
highest quality.
It's long, it's loads, it takes a while to download, no big deal, get your computer doing it and go have dinner, go do something else. But when the download's through, I used to bring it into Media Cleaner and do some things to it, and then I could finally use it in Final Cut Pro, which is what
I know what you're asking. It's easier.
Yes.
Now
okay, it's easier. Okay. Now all right,
so here's what you do. There's a free piece of software we're talking Macintosh only, okay, at the moment, because, you know.
Well, I'm a Mac guy, so I don't care. So okay. Tell us.
All right. No position on corporate holy wars here. But anyway, so there's a free program. It's called MPEG Stream Clip. It was written by some folks in Italy. MPEG, M-P-E-G, Stream Clip, one word. You can search for it, and you can download it for free. And so then what you do is you download the movie in MPEG 2, and it looks really, really beautiful, but it's really hard to work with. And you open up MPEG Stream Clip, and really quickly it converts the movie to DV format, like just like it came out of your camera. And you can edit DV format in iMovie or in Final Cut Pro, or even put it on a disc and bring it over to a PC. And it's free solution, and no more $600 media cleaner or media cleaner you got for free that doesn't work anymore, or spending all night trying to get the picture and sound to match up properly. It's a lot easier.
Boy, those were the days. I think
the geeks can, you know, address the challenge and yes, took care of it.
Yes, I know that I actually never completed that whole step when it was all those steps you had to do. But fortunately for me, some of my partners, one of whom is just down the hall, were tenacious enough to pull that off and make it happen, especially when we were making Boom. So that was good. Well, I'm glad to know that. I'm glad to tell our listening audience about that. Again, it's called Stream DV.
MPEG Stream Clip. It's a free download.
MPEG Stream Clip. So there you have it. So that makes this archive.org site such a valuable and usable tool for all you people out there listening, and I hope that
it's almost 2,000 movies at the moment.
2,000 movies, lots of decades represented. It's amazing stuff that's there. Let's talk a little bit about, so that's in this sort of, that's an archival effort that is awesome, and it's big, and it's going on the internet and sort of electronic media. You guys are involved in archiving here just locally in San Francisco, all kinds of materials at the library that you've set up. It's called the Prelinger Library, and in parentheses, appropriation friendly. Can you tell us a little bit about the vision for starting that and what that means now, what it is?
Sure. Well, we're both have been kind of amateur scholars along the way in our life paths, and have come at collecting books from different directions, partly because working outside of the academy, you don't always have access to closed stack items, and you don't always have access to the kinds of communities of knowledge that are reified in academies. And we really wanted to put our resources together and start looking at what libraries we're getting rid of and just think through the whole idea of what happens when you put printed matter together and try to create a community resource that's available to anyone, and you don't, there are no closed stacks, and you don't have to be paying enrollment fees, and it's not a general popular reading collection like you're going to find at the public library. It's really to serve the interests of people working on their own and in communities with arts and research and ideas. And we also started to think about, you know, what kinds of access can we provide to the stuff that we're collecting. And so putting together things that public libraries are getting rid of and private libraries are also getting rid of, and then putting them together in a public place where we have a digitization workstation and Xerox machine, and we encourage the use of digital cameras. We've put together resources that we hope are biased towards stuff that's in the public domain and stuff that's really rich with images to facilitate the work of artists and appropriators, because we're in an appropriation culture. And so we really wanted to think through the idea of what a library can be in our own way that's really access-oriented, both institutionally and in terms of its terms of use, and also in terms of how the materials are arranged. So in all those ways, it's access-oriented.
You want to talk about the whole browsing thing? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's where it comes in, how the materials are arranged. One experience, even if a person has access to a research library, is especially in a closed stack situation, you have to know what you're looking for in order to get it. And the process of, in that kind of query-based research model, the process of discovery is really controlled and limited.
You have to ask for something on the computer. So you can't browse. You're not going to get surprised.
Or you have to ask your research librarian.
Right. If you don't know the name of the thing you're looking for, you can't just, you're not going to chance upon it. You have to know it.
Exactly. So we wanted to build something that was browser friendly. And I mean, more than just browser friendly, but that kind of demands an experience of discovery of its users. So the subject materials are arranged in a couple of iconoclastic ways. First of all, in most libraries, you've got periodicals in one room, books in another room, government documents in the basement, if they're there at all, and then ephemera, if it's there at all. It's maybe in a, you know, rare book area or something.
Yeah, he's talking about like pamphlets and folders and maps. And
yeah, that's like what I mean by printed and ephemera, yeah. Zines. So what we've done is actually kind of co-locate all that stuff. So if you're in a subject area like Bay Area history, you're going to find the maps, the atlases, the books, the government documents, the zines and the periodicals that relate to that subject all together, so you can browse them.
Wow, so it's not arranged by the media format. It's arranged by the topic.
Exactly.
No Dewey Decimal System either.
Right. We wanted to break down barriers between media categories. I mean, media within the confines of printed materials, and just toss stuff together that would otherwise be really brought widely separated in other kinds of libraries. And also, it's arranged associatively. I mean, it's, yes, kind of a map of the insides of our minds, but we've been encouraged by the fact that people who've worked there more than an hour have said that the mode of arrangement comes to seem intuitive to them over time. It is logical within its own limits how the subjects weave into one another and relate to one another. And in every subject area, we have some kind of clusters of ideas that are represented. So parts of the library kind of talk back and forth to one another. You know, our business collection has been collected because it's a kind of a back door to labor history. Whereas, you know, on the other side of the room, we've got landscape and land use history that, you know, may have some links to what's over in business that you wouldn't expect, because we might have had some similar things in mind when putting those two collections together. So it's kind of an integrated collection in that way, in ways that other libraries I don't think are.
I was just also going to say, one of the things that we discovered when we started to put this together, and what happened, by the way, in June, we got that space downtown, because now it's cheaper to rent commercial space in San Francisco than it is to rent mini storage units, because of the collapse of commercial real estate here. So it was kind of like an old-time house raising. We had 59 of our friends come to a shelving party. And we spent 8 days.
That was great.
As organized. It was kind of an amazing event.
If any shelvers are listening, thank you.
Thanks to our honored shelvers, yeah. One of the things you discover when you work with something like this is like you were talking about the World War II material, is just so surprising what you can find. You look in an old issue of like a volume of Factory Management, you know, a magazine for executives who are running factories and how to deal with workers. You just find, like Megan was talking about, this incredible, rich resource about labor history, about the experience of working in a factory, but told like from the boss's point of view. And we're just like constantly, you know, we go in there all the time now to shelf things, and we end up just reading. It's quite awesome.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad that it's there. Do you care to tell our listeners where it is, or is it some sort of secret underground thing?
Oh, no. Really,
website.
The best place to start finding it is online. We have a website for the library, PrelingerLibrary.org. And on the website, which we update it once a week or so, we say when we expect to be around for appointments. It's available to anyone who wants to use it. We've been visited by tons of scholars, artists, and really most excitingly by a lot of university classes, art and library classes. I mean, we had a class on agitprop come in, and the teacher was taught by Craig Baldwin of Other Cinema. And he had all his students, their assignment was to rifle the library for agitprop materials and then talk about what they would do with what they found. And that's been really exciting. We've only been open for 5 months. It was June of this year that we got shelved.
Wow, that's awesome. Has Melinda Stone paid you guys a visit, or do you know who she is?
Oh, we know Melinda.
Yeah, Melinda's been over.
Oh, great.
Yep.
Nice.
The other thing I want to say is, you know, we want your zines. We're trying to collect material of, you know, current and recent cultural interest. And we have a pretty decent collection, but that's really important to us to try to. We're historical, but we don't want to neglect the 21st century.
Yeah. One of the great strengths of the collection, which is to the great tragedy of libraries across the country, is the deaccessioning of periodicals. We have over 600 runs of different periodicals, runs of varying length. Everything from amateur work, which was from 1900, about independent scientists and what they were doing, to
uranium.
But also, you know, punk scenes and 21st century political literature. And it's all really important. And if anybody out there in listener land has some zines, especially anything to do with politics, history, landscape, and land use, check out the website. We have a list up there of all the periodical runs that we've got. And if you've got something that we don't have, we're always interested in talking about it. And yeah, so again, the website's the best place to start out getting to the library. And on the website, it says when we expect to be available for appointments and how to reach us to make appointments.
Okay, so it's by appointment only. But where's the physical location? Just like what part of town? Is it in South of Market?
Yeah, downtown San Francisco, South of Market, 8th and Folsom.
Okay, great. That's not an obscure location at all.
No, it's a walking distance from BART.
Wow, that's great. That's really such a neat thing that you guys are doing and so important. And, you know, once again, getting back to archive.org, I mentioned the past, the archive material that's there from the past and stuff that I myself and Angelo and many other local filmmakers were able to use. Well, yeah, there is new stuff too, and that's really cool. One thing I really liked on the site, I saw after 9/11, I was kind of looking around just to see how our culture was responding to this crisis and what kind of things were being said and what people were doing. And you had something like this, it was like a wartime movie contest or something like that. Do you remember that? It was like the moving images.
World at War contest.
Yeah, can you tell us a little about that?
The Internet Archive did a contest to they asked people to make movies about war and peace using stuff from the collection, and they could also shoot their own material if they wanted and then mix it up. And it was, I think, a $2,000 prize, and I think there were a bunch of entries, and then the winning ones are still up there, World at War. We should do that again. I think contests are awesome. There's a great Center for the Public Domain has just done a contest about, you know, make a short film about copyright and how it affects independent and documentary filmmakers. And I looked at some of the finalists last night, and a whole bunch of them use our footage. It's really funny.
Wow, that's great. I'm sure a lot of people have used your footage that you don't even know about. Well, that was a really neat contest. I did see Angelo also had a piece in there, Smash Ahead to Victory, and that featured some of those World War II, racist, anti-Japanese propaganda clips that I used, and that was where I first saw them in that edit, Smash Ahead to Victory, which is on there. I don't think it won, but it was on there.
It did win, but, you know, Angelo does great work. His film he made, Fed Up, about sustainable agriculture and organic farming and good eating. It's one of these films where there's a lot of information, a lot of people talking, a lot of things you have to kind of, inhale when you're watching that movie. And it could be really difficult. And what he did is modulated it so wonderfully with all the archival material. And it's just it's a great film. It's like an evergreen film, too. He keeps showing it. He's selling a bunch of DVDs now. It's just the kind of stuff, that it's why we did the archives.
I contributed to that film, by the way. I got the interview with Vandana Shiva. He and I collaborated on that. That was really fun. But I had this tape that was lying around. You know, what are you going to do with it? It was like an educational tape from Disney about food and about using petroleum products in food production and how that's nice and safe and all this kind of stuff. And it was one of those tapes that you put in and had the little thing that goes ding, okay, kids, today we're going to learn about why lettuce tastes better with gasoline, ding,
change the slide.
You're supposed to change the slide kind of thing, but he ended up using some of that audio in there, and that was great too. It was along with tons of stuff that he got from your site, so that is a great piece. You can learn about that on videoactivism.org, among other places. Fed Up by Angelo Sacerdoti. But, that's awesome. I wanted to talk a little bit about copyright, copyleft, this Creative Commons idea. And, you know, I don't know a whole lot about it, but I know that it's trying to say, look, here's some material that we're putting out there, we're sharing with the world. That could be us as filmmakers. That could be you as an archivist. Anyone who wants to make their music, their intellectual property, quote unquote, you know, available with some sort of respect, some sort of thing about it. Like you should give credit to the person whose material you're using. And, you know, there's some things like that, but basically it's saying, hey, let's do this copyright free, you know, and tell us a little bit about Creative Commons, you know, just the short side of that.
Well, you know, it's probably good to talk a little bit about copyright first, because a lot of people think, you know, copyright, I write something, I write a song, I make a movie, it's my property. And it's not really the same kind of property as it has a different quality. It's not like a house or like a car, you know, or like a TV. You can't really, well, you know, the founding fathers did some bad things, but like slavery and the Constitution and so on. But there's some pretty good things in the Constitution, too. And one of the things that's in the Constitution says that our government can grant authors and inventors exclusive and a monopoly on their inventions and on their creations for limited time. So, like, deep embedded in our Constitution is the idea that there's a trade-off, that you get a monopoly through a copyright or a patent for a limited amount of time, and then afterwards your work goes into the public domain, and it becomes part of that common pool of ideas and culture and information that anybody can draw from, that Disney can draw from. Disney can take a folk tale like, you know, Snow White, a fairy tale, and make a movie out of it, put their own spin on it, and make $1 trillion. Anybody can do that kind of thing with a public domain. So the public domain is a bargain. It's a trade-off. You know, when you write a song, you have the copyright. You have it for a certain amount of time. You don't have it forever. And what's been happening in recent years, as major corporations tend to buy up more and more and more of culture, especially popular culture, and you get fewer and fewer media companies, they begin to try, you know, they go to Washington and they go to the capitals around the world and they try to write treaties that give them a much stronger hold upon these, you know, works of the intellect, works of creative works. And so copyright used to last 14 years in the original days of the United States. It was 14 years. And then they added a renewal period of another 14 years. And then it went up to 28. And now if you make something by yourself, it's life plus 90. If you make a corporate work, it's 95 years. And that means, you know, it's kind of interesting. It means that things used to expire, the copyrights. So like a lot of the history of baby boomer culture is going into the public domain, but the history of so-called Gen X culture isn't going into the public domain.
Well, the other big distinction to make between current laws and the old laws is that you used to have to register your renewal. And so if people didn't care or remember to register their renewal, their works fell into the public domain.
Most works.
But now copyright renewal is automatic, so it's impossible for a work to become abandoned. Even if the author abandons it, it will not enter the public domain.
God, isn't that strange?
Yeah, and that, you know, that's since so works since the 1960s are really, and as Rick just pointed out, it's a generational divide in access to resources, because people born since the 1960s, our history is locked. You know, everything that's happened that's been copyrighted in our lifespan is locked up.
That's right, because I remember I had this argument in a class with a professor about public domain, when does something become public domain, and no one in the class really seemed to know. It was sort of like, I think it's after 10 years. So, and then I'm like, well, then, hey, look, it's 1980 and, you know, Rubber Soul came out in 1965. You know, I'm going to go get it. It's mine. You know, it's public domain. I'm going to play it and use it freely.
Yeah, well, they...
The record companies, of course, right. You know, I learned, renewed the stupid copyright thing.
The corporate attorneys have been really on top of that for a really long time and have been working off the headlines of the news to really change the rules about how those kinds of things played out. So now our culture is locked up.
And what it means, you know, it's like... It's like a culture needs to be able to feed on its past in order to regenerate itself.
Yeah, we need Treasure Planet.
And I mean, you can do that. You can quote anything you want. You can appropriate. You can use anything you want in a movie if you've got unlimited amount of money. If you want to use like old TV footage with music, it might cost you $10,000 a minute to use it. And any one of the people who own rights to it could say no. You know, there's no.
I know it. It's horrible. And in a way, that limits my distribution. I'm a film video maker, and if I end up using some stuff because it works really well with my thesis, I'm trying to prove a point or do something with this piece, and I happen to use little bits of media from here and there, it's amazing.
You have to stay underground. You're totally marginalized. You cannot get on prime time.
And it's, that's right.
And it's a real issue, like with people that wanted to comment on the media, you know, to use the mass media in a way that to criticize what's going on. And like Outfoxed was really the first mainstream documentary to just sort of, without any excuses, quote a lot. You know, they considered that a fair use argument.
Right. When you're supposedly using, when you're taking a piece of media and using it to show something about the media or to comment on the media, that's considered fair use. And if you use it instead to sort of back up your own thesis, or not as a critique of the media, but then that's not fair use. But yeah, fair use. I always fall back on that one, but I don't know how well it would stand up if I actually got sued.
Well, that's the thing to remember about fair use, is that it's not written anywhere as a right. It is not a right. It's only a defense that you can resort to in a court of law if you are challenged. So it's reactive rather than proactive. It's not, you know, a license to do anything at all. It's only a possible existing defense against accusations of wrongdoing. And, you know, just, that's important.
So you asked about Creative Commons.
Well, yeah, along came this guy. I think he's based out of Stanford. I'm not sure, but I forget. It may not be just a guy, maybe a woman.
Yeah, it was a number of people who had this idea.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about that. I'm not.
The idea was originally this really neat guy named Eric Eldred, actually. Eric Eldred is a guy who's a retired programmer, and he has triplets. He has three daughters, and he loves to read. He loves Nathaniel Hawthorne, actually. And he also likes a lot of, early 20th century fiction, and he wanted his daughters to be able to read it when they were at college, so he wanted to put it on a website. And he discovered that since copyrights had been extended, he couldn't do that, and so he sued a famous Eldred versus Ashcroft case, which he lost, but more about that, because you don't ever really, you know, he lost, but the whole world started to look at copyright critically. But Eric also had this idea. Eric, by the way, is now traveling around the country in a bookmobile, printing out public domain books for people.
From the Internet Archive.
Wow, that's awesome.
He went to Walden Pond, you know, in Massachusetts, and tried to print out.
I went there, and I bought a Hawthorne book from the 1800s, but I gave it to my English professor at the time. I love Hawthorne, too, by the way. Great.
I like the Hawthorne story where they burn all the books. That's kind of an interesting story. But for other, not because of, not, but anyway,
I like the one where the scientist tries to make his wife perfect by removing her birthmark, and then, of course, as soon as he sees the birthmark leaving, she starts to die, you know. Anyway, getting back to
Eric Eldred was just at Walden Pond printing out copies of Walden for people for free, and the Rangers made him leave because he was competing with a gift shop, and he actually got busted for giving away free copies of Thoreau. But anyway, other story. So Eric also had this other idea for Creative Commons, and the idea, a lot of people were thinking about this idea around the same time, and he kind of moved on it. And the idea was, okay, so we've got this copyright situation, and you know, you have to be really powerful to change those laws. Disney goes to Washington, and they whisper, and they throw some money around, and the law gets changed, and citizens kind of get ignored, and have, you know, professors and librarians have gotten ignored about that. So he thought, okay, so we have this copyright, you know, let's work around it. Why bring the state into every, you know, issue of it? Why let the state decide all these things? So he had the idea of Creative Commons. And what the idea is, if you or me or any one of us make something – We can put a Creative Commons license on it, and what that license says is some rights reserved. In other words, it isn't all or nothing anymore. It's like, I have a copyright, but if I put a Creative Commons license, I can say free for non-commercial use or free for use with attribution, which is credit. You know, this is good. This comes from, you know, Megan Preilinger, blah, blah, blah. And so Creative Commons is a way of, you know, saying yes. It's a way of being permissive. So like our films online have a Creative Commons public domain license, and that's a notice to anybody that you can go ahead and use this stuff any way you want. Other work has a Creative Commons license. There's like the film I recently made as a Creative Commons non-commercial with attribution. So anybody can use that material non-commercially if they say where it comes from. And kind of neat things happen when you put a Creative Commons license. I mean, yeah, people will remix and all that kind of stuff. Somebody liked the film, they downloaded it, they entered in a film festival, you know, on my behalf. They pay the entry fee, and they not as their work, because they got to do the attribution. But it's a really wonderful way of contributing to that whole kind of exchange of ideas and exchange of, you know, culture that needs to accelerate.
And it's a way of taking back the discourse boundaries from the federal government, which is really important because the whole idea of copyright prior to Creative Commons was constituted by received ideas that we were taught in school that had been issued by the government, and makers of works did not have their own language, much less their own legal system with which to discuss, trade, and borrow and appropriate or just appreciate each other's works, and or a way to really restate their own terms of property, what property claims they wanted to make. And again, Creative Commons is a way of making proactive the idea of property claims and taking it away from something that the government is just handing to us. And
it's a key point I think you make. It's when it's like, why can't the people who produce something, the creators and their audiences, make their own arrangements about how they want, you know, how they want people to deal with the work, and how they why does this have to be decided by the state? Why does the government have to be involved? Why do you have to sue somebody, you know? So take that back. And what Creative Commons and a lot of this other stuff like copyleft points to is not just different ways of thinking about intellectual property, but different ways of thinking about property altogether. So it's potentially, it's pretty radical stuff.
I must say, as a film video maker, it also really is helpful as a way. Oftentimes we might not have a budget to send copies out to all the people that we really want to, as a film video maker, I really want to empower people who are not going to be greedy with the work, who are going to do something good with it. They're going to show it at a public event, something to kind of raise awareness. You know, they may re-edit with it some or whatever, but their big thing is that they're not going to make money with it. They're trying to get the idea out there, trying to spread the word, as it were. And it's hard because then you have to have a budget to send them your stuff. You have to send them each a copy. So the great thing, the combination of archive.org and these Creative Commons, is that you can just download it and burn it on a DVD and then show it at your thing, you know. And if you've contacted us especially and told us about your screening, that's really nice. Then we can say yes, and we didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to send you anything. The screening happened. That's great. And it's, I don't know, Mark and I, in the past, we've struggled with this, like, because we've lost some stuff. We've lost, you know, the rights to stuff, and we've lost some stuff, and we've been felt kind of abused by people at times. But, you know, we don't want to lock everything up, you know, just because of a few bad experiences. So I think it's, in essence, we were kind of writing our own Creative Commons contracts with people. We'd tell them, you can have it for free, but you have to credit us, and you can't resell it. You can't become a broker of the footage that's contained in this thing that we're giving you. We're allowing you to use it for your specific purpose, your new piece or whatever.
Yeah, you know. That's just what Creative Commons does. But the Creative Commons became a project of the Stanford Law Center. So with the Creative Commons license, it's actually written in legalese. And there's also a version that's written of your contract that you program yourself on their website. You select your options that you want, and it generates a contract for you. And it's also written in like bit language or ASCII language, so files get encoded. And I'm not the person to explain that. But computers can talk to one another and communicate Creative Commons licenses to one another in language other than English.
It means what you can do is you can go online and you can search for like media clips that are Creative Commons licensed. For example, that's one of the easiest things you can do. So everything you're working with is pre-cleared. So you're not going to get heartbroken by running into something you can't use.
It's a big problem right now. I will say I'm the video activist kind of in that world, or have been, and it's a really tricky thing, and especially when you're how to define. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying this is some of the finer points of what's going on with this. Is like, how do you define nonprofit sometimes, So it's like,
oh yeah, no kidding. For example, is KQED, is PBS nonprofit?
Right. So then there's this institution that's contacting us that we know has way more money than us, way more broadcast reach, way more, resources, than us. And they want our stuff for free, and they'll point to this, hey, well, we know you gave it to the inner city youth group over here for free, why don't give it to us, And so there's all these weird kind of academic, quasi-academic groups with more money than us that have taken our stuff. They didn't ask a lot of times, and they just took it, And that made me mad. It hurt my feelings, It's like I'm not going to work with them anymore, and that's really sad because you mentioned this word, a sort of a community. I forget what it was, like a Creative Commons community or some sort of a relationship going on there. When you want my stuff, you want to use it, that's fine. But it's so nice to ask, just to ask. That's really usually all it would ever take. And sometimes it is problematic. When you mentioned like the term of ownership, or how long do you get to hold on to something? You know what I mean? And a lot of times for people in the media activist world, they don't get to hold on to it at all. As soon as they make it, other people are taking it, using it, putting their name on it, it's gone, And so a lot of them drop out. It gets really discouraging after a while. You've put your time, your money, to get together what little resources you can to make this thing. It was your vision. And as soon as you put it out there, somebody with more money, more access than you went on tour with it and didn't even mention you, Yeah. So, there's all kinds of stuff like that, but I think this Creative Commons thing is a way to really address this, because I don't want to just slam down a real tight, copyright on everything, but I want to create a community, create a dialogue. It may be that I'm going to New York with my piece and I would like to premiere it there. And if you show it at your anarchist info shop with 10 viewers that are already going to see it anyway, I'm going to give it to you guys when I get there, But if you insist on showing it before I get there, then we lose the premiere. We can't get the premiere in the big 300-room cinema. We lost that chance to reach beyond the choir for once. And so there's just something about this media activist community as it is right now that doesn't understand about this, about, hey, maybe these people have a plan for how they want to screen, this is what democracy looks like. Maybe they'll give it to us later. what I mean?
It's like, I think one of the things that the, activist community in general, not just the media activist community, I think really needs to strongly defend authors' rights. But it's not incompatible when you talk about a strong defense of authors' and creators' rights with like a thriving gift economy, and also trying to work out alternative methods of exchange. We don't have to do it the way that the conventional media does. And Creative Commons is one step in that direction. Another step is to like, for example, for people to get together and work out some kind of a unified approach to the commercial media, so that if you know, ABC Nightline is doing something, you know, doing a story on tree sits, you know, they don't go to one place and get something for free after they try to go somewhere else, and you know, so
that's a great example.
I know you've had an issue of footage being used, like, you know, by
and you know, if somebody doesn't give it to ABC and then they contact somebody who knows what they're doing, it's not about the money. Do you know what I mean? That's not the thing. We had a guy we were working with who was really good at dealing with the mainstream press, and what he would ask for licensing fees would to have words included or to have shots included. So it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to give you the Julia Butterfly interview that you want. Okay, I know you want that. I got it. Here it is. But if you play this, if you want to use it, that's fine. Don't have to pay me anything. Credit me. Forget it. All you got to do is show a 2-second clip of a tree getting cut down, show a 2-second clip of a clear cut, and then show a 2-second clip of a mudslide. And I'll give you all this footage, you know. So show these three clips in succession, and the footage is yours, you know.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. So then you had this interview with Julia Butterfly, and then you had these three cutaways that told this story right away. Cut the tree down, clear cut, mudslide, you know. Okay, then these, like, New Agers from New York took it all over, and they were like, oh, we know better than you. We're more educated. We blah, blah. You know, we'll take it. We'll do better, you know, better distribution, blah, blah. And they proceeded to, like, you know, blow it, basically. You know, they didn't get any more press coverage about Julia Butterfly. Footage was just harfed away, you know, and lost its value, its uniqueness. You know, there's just been lots of problems with footage being, you know, leaking out there in ways that makes it less effective, because really you're trying to be effective as a media activist, you know, and I'm on my pedestal here. But the main thing is people sometimes have plans, and the plans don't always involve making big money. For us, they never have. And, they, you know, we always lose more money than we make on these ventures. But if we had the chance to go through a screenings phase with our work, we could reach way more people than just the sort of, like, you know, activist ghetto that is going to get our stuff for free eventually anyway, you know. But anyway,
you know, the other thing, I was just going to go back to our personal story a little bit and say, I mean, we live our livelihood as selling stock footage commercially. There's a company in New York that reps us, and if you want to get if you need a written license agreement, which everybody in major TV or Hollywood or advertising always needs, or everything in writing, you have to pay. And if you want a high quality, you know, video physical element like tape, you have to pay. But if you're willing to just take the Creative Commons license and download, it's free. And what's interesting, you know, that like stratifies it, two tiers. Just about anybody doing something that's independent, that's grassroots, that's community, that's student, that's artwork, is going to be able to work with a download. And we don't have to know about it. You know, no money, no writing, no one. But somebody who wants all the paperwork, they pay, because, you know, then we indemnify and we tell them, and they should have to pay for that. And what's interesting is, since we started giving stuff away, we sell more. And that's the paradox.
Wow.
But it's really true. You know,
you are just like one big positive vibe about this.
I mean, no, but nothing, it's, you know, we've been
nothing sarcastic I can say about it. It's great.
It's like you know, and I don't mean to get new agey about this, because, you know, the gift economy can be abused. Like, I'm not going to go stop on the street somebody who's got, you know, a cup, holding out a cup in their hand and say, hey, the more you give society, the more you get back. You know, that's bullshit. But on the other hand, as far as, like, footage licensing is concerned, it actually is really true that the more your material gets out there, the more the imagery gets into the culture, the more people see it, the more people want to use it. It's like the example I always give, Stairway to Heaven. You know, the value of that song is not diluted because it's played on the radio every 30 seconds sometime in America, you know. It gets more valuable.
Oh, not to me. I heard it once.
No, I know, not to me either. But I mean,
too many school dances.
Totally.
Like, but slow dance song from hell.
But anyway, this is the thing about culture, that it's not diluted by repetition, and, you know, it gets more valuable. And so there's an argument, and I think the argument really is for like people that are doing independent and activist work to try to present, you know, a more unified and stronger front, you know, get together some kind of a co-op or some kind of group to represent them to the outside world to sell the footage, and then split the money back up. I think there's ways to be more powerful, and you know, then you could play the good cop bad cop thing much more effectively.
No, I totally agree. We've got to do that better. We've reached a new level of maturity, let's say, to put a good spin on it, where we actually have something that's valuable that people want, that has, you know, value, you know, money value in the economy sense, and it also has value culturally. And, you know, so what often happens to the video activists is often not quite so positive, because as their work gets out there and they're not represented with it at all, their work just kind of gets taken from them, and it kind of gets diluted, and it gets presented by other people. And so,
well, people get really busy too, you know, like after the RNC in New York, you read everybody's leaving, people are leaving town. Who's going to watch the tapes? Who's going to archive the tapes? Can we even afford to keep stuff, or is it going to get erased? And you know, there's like nobody's on it because people have other things to do.
Well, and the relationship's been abused. And that's why it's really important for us to maintain some integrity with each other. And so for there to be somebody there in New York that we trust, we left our archive in Seattle, and immediately like two big agreements that everybody had agreed on were broken. You know, we said we won't re-edit with this unless we give you a call. And then we learned that there was a 1-hour re-edit going around the streets, and they, you know, they hadn't even give us a call really. And that's all we wanted was a call, just a chance to say, okay, yes, you know, or whatever. And, you know, just a lot of things happened, and it was bad news. And then, again, it happened in Los Angeles. There was like a sort of like this feeling like, oh, it's all creative and all, we're all sharing. It's all equal. It's all good. You know, give us everything you have. Sign this.
That all happens.
Give us that. Sign here. Okay, you're out of here. We hired a professional editor to edit on Avid with all your stuff, and there's no collaborative editing process at all. We've taken your material, and we're going to make this thing we think's more professional. It's going to have a broader reach, you know, than what you anarchist would do. So why don't you just, you know, get out of our hair? And so that happened in Los Angeles, and then after that, it's kind of like, oh gosh, you know, who wants to participate in this anymore? You know, we've got to be able to set up a relationship, a way where we can trust the people we're kind of working with, or at least that we have a way of sort of, you know, protecting ourselves, but sharing, because it's really, we want to be empowered to share. That's what it's all getting down to. It would be really easy to say no to everybody, you know, and just hold on real close to it. And that's frankly what most filmmakers do. And that's the filmmaker way. It's kind of like, I've got my vision. I'm the only one who really knows what I'm doing with this footage. That's why I got it. I'm going to go with this brilliant footage in my closet for 3 years. And, you know, when I'm done with my brilliant edit, I'll see you in 5 years, and I'll have my debut, my premiere, my name in the marquee, and get a little distribution company to pick it up, and I'll be done. And that's the way it goes. And that's the standard. That's the filmmaker, the video maker way to keep your cards close to your chest, you know, because people are trying to take it. Take that stuff, even just your ideas. But I'm trying to get beyond that. You know what I mean? As someone who's, you know, wanting, had some bad experiences, been burned a couple times, still in the game, still giving stuff away, you know, and still happy to give stuff away. But, you know, anyway, that's why I like
think it's just one of these things, you know, that that it's not resolved by individuals doing stuff. It's resolved by people working together and setting up some structures. I mean, you know, and this is just the next step.
Yeah, and to that end, I just want to give props to you guys for being involved with this Creative Commons. I think it is a good thing. I think it's great that somebody finally tried to define this and nail it down and to make it into something that other people can use without delving too deeply into. Having said that, I want to, before we have to end this interview or something like that, I want to definitely touch on your film, because we could talk copyright all night and day, but I want to get back to your guys' work and your creative efforts. And one thing I want to talk about a little bit was Panorama Ephemera. Tell us a little bit. That had a premiere. Anyway, I want to wrap this up. I want to say thank you to you guys For coming down here and talking to us on enemycombatantradio.net to share freely with our audience out there on the internet and in some broadcast land. And I wanted to once again plug your website. Please go to prelinger.com and prelinger.net are the two prelinger sites. Archive.org, of course, is the resource site where you can download lots of free stuff.
And prelingerlibrary.org.
And prelingerlibrary.
To visit the library.org.
And I actually have a post about that up on IndieBay right now with all these nice websites right there that you can just click right on them. So thanks so much, you guys, for coming by.
Well, thank you. It's been a great conversation.